Well, the first and the only talk today is by Jean Danchau, and the title is "The Topology Proof of the KV Conjecture."
Thank you, and thank you very much to the organizers, and especially Anton for bringing me here from Australia and having me talk here. It's lovely. I'd like to start with a roughly 20-minute sketch of the entire talk, and then I'll give the 75-minute version afterwards. So first of all, the KV conjecture, as you all know, is no longer a conjecture. It was first settled in 2006 by Anton and Eckhard Meinrenken, who's not yet here. And then in 2008, I think, also Anton and Charles Tarossian reformulated it in a different language and gave a new proof, and this is the formulation that I'd like to work with. So let me remind you very quickly of the basic setup. So the conjecture was asking whether a certain set of equations has solutions, and the solution we are looking for is in tangential automorphisms of the free Lie algebra and two generators x and y, degree completed. Everything is always degree completed in this talk, and I always forget to write little hats, so if you're confused because something seems to have to be degree completed but it wasn't said, so then it is. So you're looking for a tangential automorphism of this free Lie algebra. If you don't know what that is, just think it's an automorphism. One of the equations is that if you apply f to x plus y, then you're supposed to get the Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff series on x and y, which is just log of e to the x, e to the y, which is an infinitely series. And there's another equation, which with high probability you already know, and if you don't, then don't worry about it. Okay, so what Anton and Charles Tarossian did was if you are given a solution to the KV conjecture, then from that they constructed an associator. And this associator, it doesn't really live where associators, Drumfeld associators traditionally live. They live in another space, which is called something like that. But anyway, constructed an associator, and they showed that from an associator you can also go backwards, but that wasn't explicit. That was more of an existence proof. And this way they addressed the uniqueness issue of solutions in terms of associators. And then a little bit later, I think in 2009, also Anton and Benjamin and Charles Tarossian gave an explicit formula to go from associators to the solutions of the KV problem. So the plan for this talk is to put this whole picture in a topological context, explain how these different directions arise from naturally in this topological world, and in doing so we'll give an independent topological proof to the KV conjecture, and in particular to this formula for solutions of the KV conjecture in terms of associators. So topology is much more general than just this one than just this one relation between KV and the thing that I will tell you about. It's a more a general philosophy where you can where a certain type of topological problem gives rise to equations in graded spaces, and these equations in graded spaces usually turn out to be, or often sometimes turn out to be, equations that people care about independently for algebraic reasons. So. And if you were here for, on I think the second day when Drew did his statement of opinion, then you've already heard most of this before. But let me just recap really quickly. So let K, I'll denote it by K because I want you to think about some sort of space of knotted objects. And this 20-minute summary will be extremely vague, but later everything will be precise. So, if it doesn't make too much sense, then don't worry too much about it. So, on this space of knotted objects, there are some operations. So, for example, you can think about braids, which you can multiply; they form a group. Or you can think about Renard's quasi-tangles, which form a category, where you can compose, or other things. You can think about knots, which you can cable. So there's lots of examples for this. So because it's some objects with some operations acting on them, this forms what I like to call an algebraic structure. Which really just means there's some objects which belong to certain different kinds, and there's some operations. That's all. Let me say one word about the kinds. This is important for making things precise, but not too important for this skeletal sketch. So the kinds of objects are the skeleta, which, if you're thinking about knotted anything, usually knotted anything is a certain thing embedded into R3 or embedded into R4. The skeleton is what you embed. So if you think about knots, then the skeleton is a circle. If it's links, then the skeleton is n circles. If it's a tangle, then the skeleton is some one manifold. If it's pure braids, then it's n lines, whatever. So basically, the skeleton means forget the embedding, remember the combinatorics. That's the important part. This is very general, but in order for the rest of the story to go through, we have to assume one very important property about this space of knotted objects, and it's that it's finally presented in terms of these operations. And it has some relations, and both of which there's finally many. If you remember, in Drawer's talk, this came of tangles were such a finitely presented algebraic structure. And then what the topological problem that I've been talking about is looking for an expansion for K, and that goes the following way: you first allow formal linear combinations of the knotted objects as long as they have the same skeleton, so as long as they belong to the same kind. And inside this, there's an augmentation ideal, which is just those linear combinations, say Cn, Kn, where Cn are coefficients, say in Q, and Kn are knotted things, so that the sum of coefficients is zero. And then you can form the nth power of the augmentation ideal, which relative to the operations. So as long as you can write things as a formula in terms of the operations, where at least n things come from the ideal, then it comes from the ideal. And should I do another word? Yes.
So K is a monoid, right? And QK forms algebra, right? That's why you say ideal. At least K is a monoid, right?
K is really depends on what exactly
so
you're talking about.
You say ideal, so QK is algebra, right? That's why you say I to N, yeah? Hmm. Why you want to specify?
K is sometimes a monoid, but this makes sense whatever K is. So as long as you have some operations that take more than one entry, so say you have some binary operations, then you can combine elements of I, and if you combine two elements of I say that thing is in I squared. If you combine three elements of I in some formula by whatever operations, then I say that is in I cubed.
So anyway, you assume QK is algebra, right? Commutative algebra, right?
Not necessarily. It depends. So you'll see an example of a really weird case soon. I think the word that people use for this is a multi-category. I really just mean this. You have some sets, which are the kinds of objects, and then you have some operations, which could go from several of them, say three of them to one, or take two entries from the same one, or two different ones. Alright, so if we agree on this, that we can form powers of the augmentation ideal, although power doesn't necessarily mean multiplication, then you get a filtration on QK by powers of the augmentation ideal. So you have QK, inside it you have I, inside that you have and so on, and so you can form the associated gradient with respect to that filtration, and I'll denote that by K, by A, and an expansion. From K to A, which is linear and filtered, and usually denoted by Z. And the property that defines it is a very strong non-degeneracy property, which is that if you take the associated gradient of this whole thing, associated gradient is a functor, so For K, you get A because that's its associated gradient. For A, A is already graded, so you just get A. And here you get the associated gradient of Z. And the condition is that Z is the identity. Furthermore, if you'd like to develop some kind of algebraic treatment of knot theory of any flavor, then whatever invariants you work with better have some nice algebraic properties. And namely, what we like to require is that they respect the operations in the following sense. So I'll say that it's a homomorphic expansion. If, okay, so you have K, and on K you have certain operations, so here's an operation. Then you can apply Z to K to get A. And you can apply Dir to the operation to get an induced operation on A. All of these diagrams you can require that they can use, and you do. For all operations. So, what does it take to find a homomorphic expansion? In the beginning, we assume that K was finitely presented. So, to find a homomorphic expansion, you just have to find the values of the finitely many generators in this A, which is some graded space. But they can't be anything because the relations in K will translate to equations on these unknown values, and the homomorphicity requirement for each operation will also translate to equations on these values, so that those equations have to be satisfied. So that's how this kind of topological problem of looking for expansions, or in knot theory they are also called universal finite type invariants, translates to an algebraic problem of solving certain equations in graded spaces. So, as many of you know, certain types of three-dimensional knot theory, if you feed it through this machinery, gives rise to the equations that define Grünfeld associators. And this is the work of many people. Murakami, Otsuki, Shakti, Lee, Dor. And I studied this in my thesis as well. So this is pretty classical, furthermore, a similar flavor of four-dimensional knot theory in the exact same way gives rise to the KV equations. And this is by Dreuer and myself. So, in order to make sense out of this relationship between associators and solutions to the KV problem, one needs to understand the relationship between three-dimensional knot theory and four-dimensional knot theory. I'll put knots in quotation marks because it's not really knots, it's a little bit more complicated, but just for now, let's call them knots. So, in fact, there is a map from three-dimensional knots to four-dimensional knots, which later I will call A, and is also, it has some topological names, tubing or spinning. And then here we have an expansion, a homomorphic expansion. I'll call this ZU for U for usual, and this one I'll call ZW for welded. So ZU, this goes to A usual, so the associated grid of three-dimensional knots. And this ZU is in one-to-one correspondence with associators, trifold associators. Namely, there's a certain element in here. I'll just draw it, it won't make sense, and then later it will make sense. Well, maybe it already makes sense to some. This goes to phi, which is an associator. And that basically, morally, that determines ZU completely. And if you find a ZW here, that would go to the appropriate associated gradient space, which I'll denote by AW. Now this, on the other hand, is in one-to-one correspondence with solutions to KV. And then there's an induced map alpha between the associated induced by A here. Then if you find this ZW so that this whole diagram commutes, then that explains one direction of Lyapunov Taurasian, right? Because if you just take this element, send it over by A, then apply ZW, then you would get the image of phi, which is exactly the associator in this KRV30, which is a subspace here. And furthermore, all the other spaces that are studied by Lyapunov Taurasian are also live inside here. So the T-aught and the cyclic words, all those live inside this AW, and in here, in AU, here lives the TN of many talks before. So this explains one direction of Alexeyev Taurasian. You can get this explains how you get phi from a solution F. What it doesn't explain is how you get an F from a phi, so the Anton Benjamin and Taurasian paper. And the key to that is the following fact. The goal of this talk will be to prove that the generators, or the most important generator in here, can be expressed in terms of the image of A and operations that make sense in 4D. And that is a non-trivial fact because the algebraic structure here will be weird, as you will very soon see. and sort of this is not, this is kind of an awkward space. That will be the whole problem. So making sense of the whole thing will not be so trivial, but that's the basic idea. We take the image of the 3D things and apply some operations in 4D and express the generator which gives you the solution to KD. So we express the most important generator of 4D in terms of A of 3D and four-dimensional operations. And I believe that concludes the 25-minute sketch. So I'm only 5 minutes over, that's great. Okay, so the next step is to zoom in and understand different parts of this picture. So we'll first define what this space really is, and then we'll define what this space really is, and then we'll talk about the relationship between them.
Can you tell what is the difference under the A arrow or something?
Tubing. This is tubing. This is a topological name for that map. I'll explain later. So the three-dimensional space of knots that I'm talking about is actually knotted trivalent graphs. And I will abbreviate that by KTG. So what this is a framed-oriented trivalent one or two tangles. What that means, I'll show you by drawing a picture. So you take a graph which has always trivalent vertices, except it can have one or two univalent vertices. That those are the ends. And let me draw some more just to make it more interesting. And you embed that into R3. And there's certain things here that I'm ignoring. In particular, the vertices have signs, and the vertices have cyclic orientations. One can't go
so
into...
So cyclic ordering, yeah?
Cyclic ordering of the edges that come out of the...
And what the word framed means here?
Framed means that there's a framing on every edge, and the framings have to agree in some specific... So these are the objects, and if you remember Gwenaël's talk, this is very close to what he was talking about, the quasi-tangles. So if you remember, his tangles were like, there was some parenthesization on the top and on the bottom, and in between there was some tangle. This doesn't have the right number. something like that. And then you can get a KPG from that if you connect all of the points at both the bottom and the top, and how you connect them by a binary tree, and the binary tree is determined by what the parameterization was. So just connect the things that are together in a parenthesis, and then you get a KPG. So it's a little bit more general, but it's almost equivalent. So what are the operations on these gadgets?
Are there any restrictions on the orientations?
No. Any edge can be oriented anyway, but then there's restrictions on the operations depending on the orientations, which I will sweep under the rug.
So at each vertex you can have all edges, you know, coming or all going?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is the orientation switch, so you have some edge oriented this way called E, then switch E makes it into an edge oriented the other way. You see? And then next, the two interesting ones, there's an insert operation. If you have a tangle T with an edge E somewhere, it could have one end or two ends, doesn't really matter. And you have another tangle S, then you can insert S into E, and what you get is as if Pac-Man ate S. Cousin of that is stick-on. So if S has only one end, then you can stick it onto an edge. Obviously, there's lots of technical details that I'm ignoring. So vertices have signs. What sign will this vertex be? Let me ignore. And one more. I'll write it on this side. Zip, a very important one. Is the following: if you have some edge E which ends in two vertices, then you can unzip E, and what it means is you double it along the framing and connect to the appropriate edges, so those vertices disappear. And of course, the orientations have to match for this to make sense. But let's assume that they match. So if you are Gwennell, or if you remember Gwennell's talk, he had a similar operation which was called the vertical strand doubling, and his condition that it's vertical corresponds to a condition that we have when the two vertices have a different signs. Okay, so that's the algebraic structure. So these are the elements, those are the operations. So as you can see, the operations are pretty unusual. It's not a group, it's not a category, not a planar algebra. But nonetheless, it turns out to be finitely generated, in fact finitely presented. And this is a theorem in a paper by Jordan and myself. But it's similar to a theorem on a different version of KDGs, which is, I think, by Dylan Thurston. So finally generated by the following elements, single strand. Pretty simple. A bubble, a twist, what we call an associator, which is kind of a hint, and a bubble. Now, it's kind of it's a bit of a simplification. There's an opposite twist, there's a left associator, and there's a noose, which differs from the bubble in vertex science, but this is enough for the purpose of this discussion. And it turns out that when you write the relations are basically a pentagon equation on the associator and hexagon equations on the associator and the twist. And when you're looking for an expansion, that's how you get an associator. So the associated gradient space AU, that is a space of Jacobi diagrams or chord diagrams on these trivalent skeleta. What does this mean? It means the same as in everybody else's talk. KTG skeleton means, as I said before, whatever you embed. So a trivalent graph that you embed, something like a piece symbol with two ends or something like that. And it has some chords on it. The chords, if you're talking about Jacobi diagrams, can also have trivalent vertices. And there are certain rules. So these rules are given by the same relations that everybody else who talked about such things has been talking about. So SDU, anti-symmetry, IHX. I will not write them on the board once more. It also won't be overly important. There's one more relation that you need to pose to deal with the vertices, and that's called vertex invariance, and it just means that attaching a chord on this on one edge meeting at the vertex, or the same chord on the other edge, or the same chord on the other on the third edge, it sums to zero or differences. The plus or minus depends on the orientations of the edges that you have. But the only thing to take away from this is that it's a space with some entirely combinatorial description, nonetheless a complicated one. There is homomorphic expansion which is in one-to-one correspondence with Drinfeld associate, not a homomorphic expansion, this many homomorphic expansions. They are indexed by Grünfeld associators. So ZU is determined by ZU on this guy, and I guess ZU on the twist, which is the R matrix. And phi and r form a Grünfeld associator pair. A side comment, also not very central, but just for the sake of being a bit more precise, these Grünfeld associators are a little bit more general than the Grünfeld associators living in Tn. So those living in Tn appear, those we call horizontal quark associators, but this also allows associators where the quarks go crisscross each other, which are also perfectly fine associators, but we will not use them in this talk. So we'll take a break in a few minutes, so let me just give you the sort of short introduction to the four-dimensional version, and then I'll do the proper four-dimensional version after the break. So, as you all know, the braid group, the usual three-dimensional braid group, is the group of crawling ants. Because if you have n ants crawling on the table, then at the time dimension, that will be n strings braided in R3. And if they get back to the same spot, then it will be a braid. So, to say that a bit more mathematically, the braid group is the fundamental group of the configuration space of n distinct points in the plane. And there's a direct analog of this, one dimension up, and that's called the Welby braid group, or W braid group. Dora and I just like to call it W. So instead of the group of crawling ants, this is the group of flying rings. So what does that mean? If you have some rings flying in R3, then you add the time dimension, that becomes four-dimensional, so you just get some braided tubes in R4. So this is the welded. Braid group, which is can also be called the group of flying rings. More precisely, the fundamental group of the configuration space of n disjoint horizontal geometric circles in R3. Horizontal, I mean they must fly horizontally, can't flip. There's also a version where they can flip, but we are not doing that version for simplicity. Alright, but so that's a topological description, but we like to treat these structures in an algebraic way, or more combinatorial way, and you all remember that the braid group has another description, the Rydermeister description in terms of generators and relations, and that is true for the W-ray group as well. So let me just write the generators and relations, and then I'll explain them topologically. So it's generated by the crossings between strand I and I plus 1. And there's another kind of crossing, which I'll explain. So this is for all I between 1 and n minus 1. And modulo the relations, Rydermeister 3, virtual Rydermeister 3, mixed, the mixed relation, the locality in space, and one more, the overcrossings for me. So let me explain. First of all, when you have points in the plane, what can they do? They can switch places. One can go in front of the other, or the other can go in front. This is in the plane. And these two things are the two different crossings in the ray group. And these are inverses of each other. And doing the same crossing, so the two points on the plane circling around each other however many times, that's how you get the grade. That's how you get the grade. That's not homotopic to doing nothing. Now, in R3, if you have two rings and they just switch places like that, or they switch places the other way, no matter how many times you do that, you get no braiding because you have an extra dimension. This is homotopic to doing nothing. So switching places while kind of avoiding each other, not interacting with each other, is an uninteresting kind of crossing, and that is the virtual crossing. In fact, I think I forgot the relation with VR2. So VR2 says that if you do two virtual crossings, that's like doing nothing. And that means that that crossing is uninteresting, it produces no braiding, and it just means the two rings kind of switch places while avoiding each other. The interesting crossing, the actual braiding, happens in a different way. That happens when one ring decides to fly through another. Now, I didn't say the radii of these rings is not fixed, so although they have to stay horizontal, they can shrink a bit or expand a bit, so any ring can fly through another ring by first shrinking a bit. So if this blue guy flies through the yellow guy and then flies through again, that's how you get braiding between these two. And that is the crossing. And doing it the opposite way, so the crossing is this, the undercrossing, the other crossing, which is the inverse, is like doing the movie backwards. So this crossing means one ring flies through the other. And that's how they trade places. And then all the virtual Rydermeister moves, which just deal with the virtual crossings, are not interesting because the virtual crossings themselves are not interesting. In fact, you can give the whole description without talking about virtual crossings at all. Rydermeister 3 is interesting, and it's still true, but it's true for a completely different reason than Rydermeister 3 for the normal grade group. But the one that I would like to talk about is the overcrossings commute, which is a Rydermeister 3 type relation. It says that if you have a strand which crosses over a virtual crossing, then you can move it to the other side. So what does this mean? Why is this true? Let's number these strands. In fact, let's I have white blue and yellow, and the blue and yellow are the small ones, so we make this yellow and this blue. So what does this mean? Let's say everything is oriented up, and the orientation up is the direction of time. So in this picture on the left, let's not worry about the virtual crossing, because that just means that the blue and the yellow switch places while avoiding each other, so who cares? But the real crossings mean that the yellow flies through the white, and then the blue flies through the right. Okay, so that picture is first yellow flies through the white, and then blue flies through the white. The other picture, the only difference is that first blue flies through the white, then the yellow flies through the white. So first blue goes, then yellow goes. Now the relation says that these two are homotopic. Well, of course they are, because the blue and the yellow could kind of fly into each other, not fly through, just fly into, just barely, and then fly through the white together, and then undo it, like not actually do anything. So yes, that's homotopic. And another interesting point is that the opposite is not true. So over and under are now not symmetric, because so what would be the under crossings commute relation? It would be something like that. So let me again make the smallest one is the blue. Okay, so this one means that blue goes through the white and then it goes through the yellow. This means that it goes through the yellow and then it goes through the white. So one side is like, here's the yellow, here's the white, the blue goes all the way through. And the other side is, here's the yellow, here's the white, and the blue goes all the way through. Now, if you want to do a homotopy between the two, then the blue would first have to go through in this configuration from bottom to top, so first yellow, then white. Then, at some point, it would all have to happen at the same time, so the yellow and the white have to be within each other. And after that, the blue has to fly through first the white and then the yellow, so the yellow has to come out to the top. So what happened here secretly, the yellow flew through the white. So this relation has an actual true crossing between the yellow and the white, because it flew through. So this would really be a real crossing here, and the real crossing here, and this is the actual Rademeister 3 relation. So there's no undercrossings commute, but yes, R3. And it's not surprising at all that the overcrossing and the undercrossing are asymmetric, because their very definition is asymmetric. One of them flies through the other. That's inherently asymmetric. All right, so let's take a coffee break, and then I'll be back.
Thanks a lot. Any questions before the coffee break?
So, you mentioned the fact of training for explaining what should be an expansion. You mentioned that you require that the set of objects was finitely presented. But is it so important? Because we could imagine that the space is infinitely generated, infinitely presented, but the family of generators and relations are all of the same kinds. We could also imagine to compute the equations in that case.
So there's definitely expansions for spaces that are not finitely presented, like the conservative integral for knots. So yes, I mean, a lot of the same things make sense in that setting as well. So for example, for knots, you can't exactly do things this way because you don't have a finite presentation. The augmentation ideal doesn't, like, you don't get the Vasiliev filtration by taking powers of the augmentation ideal, but still you can get the Vasiliev filtration in another way, and you can construct the Concevich integral. So things still work, but the whole point here is to kind of find bridges between knot theory and problems in algebra, and these particular problems that you're talking about, associators, KV equations, they are finite sets of equations in Greece. So that's why I'm restricted to the case.
In the associated gradients, for Kelvin's work needed for the associated gradient, is it true that it's also finitely represented in all previous equations?
Yes.
And the number of relations are the same as it was before taking the associated gradients. We can arrange them in the same way before taking the associated gradients, or there are more?
So it's a little bit different. When you try to identify the associated gradient, it's usually easy to come up with kind of a candidate space. And the candidate space, this is the sort of the sample candidate space. You'll be looking at some sort of core diagrammatic space, and then an easy thing is to find a surjective map from this to the associated gradient, and then the hard part is to identify the kernel of that map. So the kernel of that map has certain relations which do come from topology, and they do come from sort of Rademeister relations, but not necessarily one single Rademeister relation. Like the vertex invariance here, it comes from the topological fact that if you have a vertex and you thread another strand all under it, or thread another strand all over it, then that's the same thing, and it's the same by a sequence of Rademeister moves. But to begin with, the Rademeister moves were in the actual relations here, because this space is not—it's not a space of tangles. So it's not the generators. It's not like you have these little local things which you connect, and then the Rademeister moves are the actual relations. So it's a little bit different.
So you do not have a presentation of the associated gradient in terms of finite gradient in terms of generators and relations. So you just have a kind of map from some object, and you know how these relations look like.
No, I believe you do. Actually, for KTGs, I've never actually written this down, but I believe you do. You have these, basic graphs that you can construct any graph from using these insert and other operations, and your generators would be like a single chord on a basic graph, and then you would connect these using inserts and things. If you want more than one chord, then you would do it multiple times. So I think you could still do that.
Okay. Any more questions?
Well, if not, let's take a relatively short, like 10 minutes. wait.